This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
My guest is Dana Golan. Dana is Executive Director of Breaking the Silence. It's an organization of veteran Israeli soldiers that collects anonymous testimonies. So far, they've gotten over 650. These are men and women who served in the occupied territories since 2000. And in Israel, military service is mandatory, both for men and women. Women don't have to be combatants, but some are voluntarily. Once in a while, the law changes. There may be some provisions I'm not quite current on, but I think basically what I said is accurate. If it isn't, I'll let Dana correct me. From November 2001 to February 2004, Dana served as an IDF, that's the Israeli military, Israeli Defense Forces, an IDF non-commissioned officer and education officer. She studied journalism and creative writing afterwards, and she joined Breaking the Silence in January 2009. Last year, 54 damning testimonies were published from the men. I wrote about them around mid-year last year. And on January 31st this year, a new publication was released titled Breaking the Silence, Women Soldiers' Testimonies. It's a collection of 96 stories from dozens of IDF women. And I wrote about that, too. I believe it was in early February. Dana, I welcome you warmly to the program. I'm delighted to have you on.
Thank you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning to you. You arrived safely in Denver?
Yeah, I arrived safely.
You're traveling the country. It's been a while since I've traveled the country, but I've done it in the past. But you're traveling the country, visiting the U.S., talking about Breaking the Silence. Explain in your words the mission of Breaking the Silence. And you're the executive director, so you're right there in the midst of what's going on. And the Israeli men and women soldiers speaking out about what they're not too happy about.
Yeah, so basically what we're doing since 2004 until this day is actually gathering testimonies from men and female that actually served in the territories in combat missions and some of the other jobs that you are actually able to do in the territories. And by gathering these testimonies and bringing them to the Israeli public and the public around the world, we're trying to raise the awareness and to create a moral discussion about the moral price of occupation. As you mentioned, at the age of 18, most of the Israelis are actually joining the IDF. It's not a matter of choice in most cases. So we believe that if you send so many people to serve, you must let them talk when they get back. And when people are coming back from the territories after 2.5 years or 3 years, if you are a man, there is a lot to talk about because you have to confront so many of the dilemmas, the moral dilemmas that no one actually can prepare you to. And controlling civilians at the age of 18 is very difficult, almost impossible sometimes.
Oh, it really is. It's been a long time since I was in my teens, my late teens, Dana. I'm in my mid-70s. But I recollect more or less back at that time. And what I know now, you know, they talk about the wisdom of the ages. I like to joke with people and say, if I could live to age 300 or so, I'd probably be a genius. The longer we live, the smarter we get. Well, we learn more things. We understand things we never understood at times in the past. And when I was 18, I didn't have any idea about the things that I focus on so intensely now. I simply couldn't. I was just through high school. I was beginning college. We had mandatory military service back there too. We were subject to a draft. Not women, only men in the U.S. That ended in the mid-1970s because of the Vietnam War. And in recent times, there's been talk about resurrecting the draft. I am not a big fan of the draft or of militarism or of foreign wars, and no country more than my own, Dana, is guiltier of doing this relentlessly, continually. And one of the most shocking, maybe the most shocking statistic I ever ran across was when I learned, and I have a book documenting it all. It's all there in black and white. Every single year in U.S. history since 1776, and actually before that, but let's just say when America became a nation, an independent nation, this country has been at war with one or more adversaries, either abroad and or at home. There has not been a single year that America has not been at war. That is shocking, and it continues to this day. And, of course, Israel is a very belligerent state. And it's simply almost like America is looking for a reason to pick a fight with somebody. Well, sooner or later, that has a bad ending.
I'm not sure that Israel is actually searching for a reason to pick a fight. I think the reality, and this is also a big difference in the situation in the States, the reality is very complex. And it's not going, and it's not happening actually so far away from home. The distance between Jerusalem and Ramallah is nothing, mostly. Like, you can drive for 5 minutes and you're there. And as I said to many Americans here, you can live your whole life right now, even though if in the past the draft was mandatory. In these days, you can live a whole life in America without knowing a soldier. In Israel, it's impossible. And just even create much a bigger dilemma to the people that were actually sent to serve in the territories. And when they feel that they are taking part in something that is morally wrong, and that they are asked to do things that completely contradict what they've been raised into and the value system that their parents gave them, it's even a bigger dilemma, because all the people around you, and you know soldiers all the time, and you know that how important it is, and you know how much your country and your society want peace. And in a way, you feel that by serving in the army, you're taking part of this great mission. So I'm not sure that we're picking up the word. I'm quite sure that Israelis and Palestinians would give up the war if they could have really get what they want. The problem is that each side want different things. And even inside in the Israeli society, people want different things.
Well, I'm a great believer that everybody should have the right to live free in the country where they reside. Unfortunately, Palestinians live under occupation. You know that, Dana. It's been that way since 1967. At this point, it's gone beyond the point of reason and the rule of law. And I write many articles. I write many articles on many topics, but the one above all others by far has been to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And many, many times I quote the law, including Israeli law, the basic laws, Supreme Court decisions, the High Court of Justice, I've quoted their decisions. But mainly I quote the international law, which is sacred, fundamental international law. I mean, this is written in stone stuff, and a lot of it, it's been around for a long time. There are international laws that go back to the 19th century, but early in the 20th century we had the Hague Conventions, but mainly after World War II. The horrors of World War II really generated important international laws, the bedrock ones probably being the four Geneva Conventions and the additions to the conventions in subsequent years. But it's very clear. I mean, you've got the laws of war, the laws of occupation, the way you treat a civilian population. Well, in the case of Gaza and the West Bank, we're talking about civilians. The territories are occupied, even though Gaza technically is not occupied. As you well know, the IDF can go in there anytime they please. They did it last in a horrific way at the end of December 2008, January 2009, Operation Cast Lead. I mean, this is outrageous stuff, all illegal, all documented, not just by the Goldstone Commission, but by many human rights organizations, just listing chapter and verse what went on. Independent human rights organizations, Israeli ones, Palestinian ones, I've written so much on that alone. Go ahead.
In a way, we do not define ourselves as a human rights organization, especially because of that reason. We represent almost 700 soldiers, and many of the veterans, including myself, do not know by heart the Geneva Convention or the international law. We're trying to create
not.
A moral discussion, and that's why we do not take a stand with everything that has to do with the international law. We give the information. We give the information from the ground, and we put it on the table. We're trying to create this discussion because, I believe that it's not all about law. I think that international law is very important. But when I'm talking to the Israeli society, I'm trying to create some kind of commitment to the moral values that we all grew up upon. And this is something that I'm trying to do. I'm not that good with the international law, although I know that we were... people use our materials and different human rights organizations use the testimonies of soldiers, and I completely stand behind that because I think that it's as part of bringing all the information out from the territories. This is something that other organizations can do, including the Judge Goldstone and his own commission, because we were quoted in his report. But it's not something that we actually did. It was just using our materials and in a way... Actually, that this is part of our job.
Oh, I understand fully, Dana. What you talk about, the upbringing that you got, your Jewish upbringing, I imagine it was the same or very similar to the Jewish upbringing that I remember as a boy growing up. I was 14 years old before Israel became a state in 1948. So Israel was never a topic of discussion in my household. I never remember it being raised, but there was no Israel until I was almost in my mid-teens. But I remember my Jewish upbringing and the high moral standards that I was taught, both at home in Hebrew school by a wonderful rabbi at our synagogue. These are sacred precepts to me. They're the same ones that observant Christians have, and observant Muslims have, and observant religious people in all the major religions, and some of the minor ones, maybe most of the minor ones, maybe all of the minor ones. I mean, it's basic bedrock stuff. Thou shalt not kill, do unto others. I believe in this stuff. So if anybody, if any nation, if any person does anything to violate these sacred principles, that is a violation of the law, as far as I'm concerned. Thankfully, we have laws, both domestic laws and international laws, that pretty much go along the lines of these basic religious principles. And Israel affirms human rights in the basic laws. There's a lot of pious language in them. But they don't seem to afford those rights to Palestinian people, which is the heart of a very great problem and a lot of misery for people who deserve a lot better than what they're getting. You saw it firsthand, and I have not. That's the one thing I have not experienced. I've done an awful lot of writing about this, but I've never seen it. I've never been to Israel or other territories. So I don't know firsthand what you saw by serving in them. That's why what you have to say and the others is so important.
Exactly. That's why we believe that the voice of soldiers that were actually there is the most important voice to upbring outside. And in a way, I think that we felt we did not naturally started to deal with the Gaza operation last year. But when we got a phone call from a reservist that used to give a testimony already to break in the silence, and telling us, guys, you have to check what happened there. We just start dealing with that and start talking to people and interview people. And I do agree that last year, in a way, was kind of crossing every red line that we've known as soldiers. And that's why we did the best we could and published testimonies in such a fast way. But as I said again, I can only talk in behalf of the soldiers, in behalf of the soldiers that were sent by their own society actually to serve and to protect the country and to also attack the others. So I can speak on behalf of the soldier. I can speak behalf of the routines and the orders and the missions that they had to do. And in many, many ways and in many times, these orders do not actually sit with what we were raised upon. And we feel that the occupation cannot be done in a very clean way. It's impossible. It's not about educating soldiers. It's not about giving them more values. The situation itself is impossible, because as long as one side has more rights and as long as one side can enter someone else's space and even house and treat it as if it's his own house, there's no way to do it in a moral way. And I do believe that the IDF in many aspects is trying to do its best and trying to be moral. And I was part of the education corps, and I know that the IDF does talk with people about human rights, and its soldiers, it does speak about values and about the Jewish values and about morality. But again, it's an impossible situation. It cannot be done in a moral way. Occupation is immoral. That's what we're actually trying to say. And in a way, we're trying to...
Occupation is immoral, Dana, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Especially an occupation that's gone on for almost 43 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Occupation, international law speaks of occupation. Occupation is not illegal per se, but there's a limit to how long it can go on. It's supposed to be a temporary status between the end of war and the conclusion, usually the conclusion of a peace treaty. So there's an interim period where you don't want no enforcing authority on the ground, because that's like having no police in your city. So anybody can go out on the streets and do anything they want, and there's nobody around to stop them. So you need some kind of an authority to keep order, but it's supposed to only be temporary, a year, 2 years, even a few years, but never 43 years. When you cross that line, you cross into the area of illegality, and I'm afraid Israel crossed that line many years ago.
But that's why we're trying to talk. As I told you, I do not understand much in the law, although I know that occupation should be temporary, and the last 43 years is much longer than a temporary solution for a problem. However, the situation in the Middle East is very complicated, and the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians is very complicated. We in Breaking the Silence believe that there is no way to solve the problem without actually knowing it. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to put the information on the table, and we believe that every solution that may people believe that, you know, we interview almost 700 people. These 700 people have a completely different idea of what can be the solution. Even among the members and staff members of Breaking the Silence, we do not necessarily agree about the solution. But the common ground between everyone is exactly this feeling that something in our service was immoral, that we had to confront this immoral morality, and we had to confront these conflicts that we were not prepared to, that we do not believe that anyone can be prepared to. And we want to talk to the people at home and the people that actually send us to this mission and let those people to think about a solution that will be based on what's going on the ground. If someone will tell me that this is completely fine by him, and they want to create the occupation for an even longer period of time as a part of living in a democratic society, I guess I will have no choice and live as a minority. But I believe in the people in Israel, and I believe that people do care about morality, and people do care about those values that they raised me to be. And in a way, I think that the information do not get, really, from the ground. Palestinians and Israeli do not really know each other. They do not have really encounter points, except for checkpoints, or for places when the Israeli soldiers are actually controlling the Palestinian civilians. And that's what we're trying to do. This is what we're trying to put on the table, exactly those details and information from the ground. Because many people send their kids to serve in the territories and they don't know what's the meaning of standing in a checkpoint, or what's the meaning of entering a home, a Palestinian house in the middle of the night and do actually a weapons search. When my mom sent me to the Education Corps, she had no idea that I would actually have to search with my own hands on Palestinian woman body for weapons. She had no idea that this is part of the mission, and it is. And in a way, you send 18-year-old kids to this mission because it's much easier to create discipline among 18-year-old.
Dina, you're familiar with the other organization that I wrote about, and I just pulled up the article. I wrote about it in April 2008, the so-called Refuseniks. These are Israeli soldiers who will serve in the Israeli military. They will help defend the nation of Israel, but they refuse to serve in the occupied territories. Can I read you one of the statements? They make a bunch of quick bullet point statements, and they say...
Yeah, there are a few groups of refusal. I'll just say that after breaking the silence, we do not take a stand about refusal, as we don't take a stand about the solution. We believe that everyone should choose for himself. And many of the people that gave testimonies to breaking the silence are actually going back to reserve service and do it again and again each year.
Well, they have to do it, don't they? They have to do it.
Yeah, but the people in the refusal movement, the different refusal organizations are actually probably set in the military prison for a while and just finish their relationship with the army.
Oh, that can happen, absolutely. I've quoted the Israeli law, I think it's the 1986 law, regarding military service and so on, and who must serve and who doesn't have to serve. And if you fail to obey the orders you're given, the various things you can be charged with and the prison sentences they can sentence you to. Here is one of the statements from the Refuseniks. We shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. We hereby declare that we shall continue serving the Israeli Defense Forces in any mission that serves Israel's defense, and they exclude the occupied territories because that does not serve Israel's defense in their judgment. These are very courageous people.
As I said, I appreciate everyone who's doing is fighting for his own truth. I don't know if refusal is actually the answer or not. I don't know. It's really, and it's hard for me to say to take a stand about that because, as I said, many people that gave testimony to breaking the silence are still reservists and still going to serve. And I appreciate these people as well as I appreciate people who choose not to. I believe that everyone should do what's good for him. But I do believe that if there is something that the Jewish people already know, that is that we cannot just stand and do nothing. Everyone should make one step forward and take a stand for the things that he believes. And when I'm talking to people in Israel and I'm trying to create, and everybody is asking, okay, what do you actually say? You don't offer me a solution. We got used to the situation when everybody asked us to vote for him or ask us to choose two-state solution and one-state solution. Everyone wants an answer. And I'm saying I cannot talk about the answer. I'm talking about the moral issue that is the occupation actually brings up. And if one chooses to take this moral price and to say it's too high for me, I want to refuse, I respect that. And if someone else said, okay, this moral price for me is too high, but I still believe that I should serve my country because this is the law and this is what my society asked me to, so So I respect this person as well. But I do not respect people that do not take a stand at all. They just sit and let the reality to be just around the corner without them looking at it.
Well, you've accumulated some wisdom very early in your life. You cannot refuse to take a stand. The issues are too important to just say, well, I'll let someone else worry about it and just go along passively. These are major issues, life and death, liberty, equality. How can you not take a stand on issues like that? I think we agree, Dana, you correct me if I'm wrong. I think we agree that we both want peace, not war. We both want equity and justice for everybody. We don't want injustices against some people and only give justice to some people, the ones who we choose to be able to receive it. That is not what a just society is. Israel, like America, claims to be a democracy. Well, my comment is, if that's the case, then start acting like one. But the way Israel treats Palestinians and the territories and Israeli Arabs, citizens, Arab citizens of the State of Israel, they are not afforded the same rights as Jews. That is not a tolerable situation, nor is it a sustainable one. This is one thing that the refuseniks also say. These things that are going on that they simply want no part of, there is a bad ending to these. They cannot go on forever. They will end. And I hope the end, Dana, is that Israel on its own will decide, some future leader, some future government will decide that this is an unsustainable way to run a country, to treat another people. It has to end. And a line in the sand is drawn, and things begin to happen that are completely different than everything that's happened up to this point. I don't see it yet. It certainly will not be as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is president, but I'm afraid the alternatives that I see aren't very much better. And the situation is at least that bad and probably a lot worse in America. You live in Israel, so you're very concerned about what goes on there. But your country and mine are inextricably entwined. We are literally joined at the hip. There is no question about that. And one is inextricably involved in the activities of the other. But America does an awful lot for Israel. The billions of dollars it supplies every year, the weapons, the technology, All the other benefits. I recently wrote an article about it, and I mentioned it in past articles. America could exert an awful lot of pressure on Israel if it wanted to, but there are very powerful forces in America that really subvert that happening. It's called the Israeli lobby, but the Israeli lobby has very deep roots in America. It's more than just an ordinary lobby that you think about if you're lobbying for a particular industry. All the big industries in this country have lobbies, and they hire people to do it. But the Israeli lobby is deeply embedded in the grassroots of the country, very heavily with ordinary people, ordinary people and citizens around the country, in cities around the country, and they're supportive of the interests of Israel, and they're the branches and twigs of this Israeli lobby that has powerful organizations at the roots of it. But it's all of these twigs and branches that make it an extremely powerful lobby. And I could go on and on about that subject.
This is exactly why I'm here, because I know that people here have lots of influence on what's going on inside of my own country. And I want those people that influence the situation in Israel and the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis that will base what they feel and their own agenda and what they fight for according to what's going on the ground. And I believe that, and I've seen it. I'm here for almost 3 weeks, and I've been talking to American Jews and non-Jews American as well. And I know that people here, like people in Israel, do not really know what's the meaning of occupation, what's the moral meaning of occupation. Or they choose not to talk about that. But in
what do people tell you?
This is what
the people that you're meeting on your journeys through America, Dana, what are they telling you?
In many ways, I talk before they tell anything. So So I talk first, and I represent the stories, and I represent the examples for testimonies. I was showing a part of a film as well. And people are just asking, okay, but what's the alternative? What's the solution? Because people, in a way, think that this is the only way to do that. And when I'm trying to explain that the meaning of occupation, and in occupation actually creates victims in the other side in each day, is just making this, we're going in circles. We're not trying to solve the problem for real. We're just going with circles with what we've learned, and we've learned to believe that there is no other way. And I'm saying there must be another way. There must be another way, because it is impossible that we will do what we're doing, and we will become less and less human and still say that this is the only way. So in a way, Americans are very polite. They are much more polite than when people in Israel. But they do try to, I'm trying to encourage people to get more information before they make the judgment. And in a way, I believe that I'm creating a crank with people, because I tell them the story. I'm telling them that I'm doing what I'm doing, and all the members in Breaking the Silence, we're doing out of love to our own country and out of love to our own society and out of deep concern, because we're really concerned of what's going to be at the end, what's going to be the solution if people choose to solve the situation without really knowing it. And we want people to take our voice under the consideration of what they're doing as well. And in a way, I believe that people here also send, like the Israelis and Jewish soldiers that are serving in Israel are sent on behalf of the Israeli society, but they are also sent on behalf of the people here that are doing lobby to Israel.
Dana, let me just interrupt a moment. Let me alert my board man to we should be taking a break now. So if you can crank up the music real loud so I can hear it. When they did it yesterday, I couldn't hear a thing. I had no idea when I should come back. I'll let you pause and catch your breath, Dana. We'll take a minute or so break and then come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Spoke out about just a few examples of some of the things that bothered you and others so much, because you talk about the recounting by the soldiers, men and women. They talk about things that they saw firsthand, were involved in, and found very, very disturbing, and I must say so did I. Explain, give a few examples of what they talked about.
So from my own experience, I can say that we got already thousands of testimonies, because you can imagine that someone who is serving in the territories, even someone I served there in the city of Hebron for 7 months, and in 7 months you see and you get involved in so many incidents. So each of the soldiers that are actually talking to us there have many examples. Many of the examples are actually the result and the direct implication of putting people at the age of 18 and giving them power and giving them weapon and giving them the possibility to control others. So the result of that is sometimes my soldiers in Hebron were standing in the checkpoint for almost 2.5 years, a bit more. And standing in the checkpoint for so long means that you have 8-hour shift or 16-hour shift in the checkpoint, and then you have 8 hours break, which means in these 8 hours you actually have to take a nap, go to eat something, take off your uniforms and talk to your girlfriend or your family, eat something, and in less than 8 hours you're already standing again in the same checkpoint. And when you're doing that, and this is your routine for 2.5 years and sometimes even more, detaining people for no reason is part of your routine as well. Humiliate Palestinians for no reason is part of your routine as well. I know soldiers that were involved in looting, in going back to the same stores and just loot whatever they could, with not too much of the thinking. When you get a jeep and you take your friends to patrol the city of Hebron, because your commander told you just go do whatever you want, just go drive around. Sometimes my soldier would take Palestinians, young Palestinians with no reason, and put them inside a jeep, beat them up and throw them out when the jeep is still driving. And in a way, this is something that I'm sure that people that listen to us now can say, okay, but maybe you can make the shift a bit shorter. Maybe you can talk to values to the soldiers and they will be better. But it's not like that, because the soldiers are, each one of them is coming from a different background. And if each one of them was completely different person, and the situation create this kind of incidents, which are not so rare. It happens all the time. And we have another kind of testimonies, which are actually sometimes people are talking about orders and about missions that they got. For example, if the IDF wants to take over a Palestinian home and make it his own station for 2 or 3 weeks, he has the ability to do that. The justification is security. The IDF wants to control the area or the junction that the house is actually at. There's no sense in creating and building your own stations every once in a while in different places. It does not make any sense. So the way it works, you take a whole platoon of soldiers. You enter a Palestinian house. You take the family and put them in one room for 2 weeks sometimes, or even more. And you as a soldier, you have no idea for how long it's going to be, the situation. And then the members of the Palestinian family, for as long as you're there, they have to ask you for permission to go to the toilet or to open their own fridge or to go inside or outside of their own place. And this is something that is immoral. So in this situation, yes, there are some soldiers that actually loot, and there are some soldiers that leave graffiti on the wall or eat the food in the fridge. But even if the soldiers are not doing any of that, and there are soldiers and there are platoons of soldiers that actually clean the house later on, and leave it when it's all clean and neat, and they did it in the most nicest way, and they were even nice to the family. But still, for 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks, they were in someone else's place and treated as if it is own. So there is the justification of security, because apparently this is the only way to secure the people in Israel. But for many of the soldiers that talk to us, this reality is immoral for them. It made them feel that they took part in something that is morally wrong. And this is what we're trying to put on the table. It's not really just a soldier. It's not just a soldier in the checkpoint. Many of the orders that you get when you are sent to control civilians, their meaning is that you actually have more rights than the others. And this is what we want to ask. This is what I want to tell people, and I want to tell them. This is the only way the IDF knows how to prevent terror inside of Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem. But look what it is doing to us. What is it doing to the other? What it's doing to the other side? Because as I said, we create victims in any day, in every day. When I enter a place, someone's place in the middle of the night for a weapon search, and I was looking at this 4 years old kid that was looking at me walking in his own home in the middle of the night, I knew that this kid hates me. And he has any reason to do so, because I just humiliated his family. And I just enter in the middle of the night to his own place. And how did this kid will grow up to? For what? Would he like to talk to me? Would he like to open any negotiation with me? I think not. And I think in a way that this is something that is kind of hidden from the public eye, that we don't know about that. People in Israel do not know about that. And you said that the Israeli society is very militant, but the Israeli society, most of the people never been to the territories. Never. Most of the Israeli soldiers have never been based in the territories. Most of the IDF soldiers are actually based inside of Israel.
But doesn't everybody at some point or other serve a tour of duty there?
No.
Or is that wrong?
No. Most of the people, I think that's something like at least 80%, if not more, of the people never get to the territories, even as soldiers.
So they never get there at all. By the way, I wonder whether you know, you spent 7 months in Hebron. Hebron is the West Bank's second largest city. I think Ramallah is the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
It's the largest territory in the southern portion of the West Bank, and it's the only Palestinian city with an Israeli settlement in its center. And that center, it's around the old city. That center used to be the southern West Bank's commercial center, and that commercial center no longer exists.
Mm-hmm.
So the commerce of that city, of the whole, and of the whole southern portion of the West Bank, was destroyed because an Israeli settlement took over the center of that city. Well, it's only one of many, many very disturbing
stories. Yeah, but it
stories.
Is very, but it is very extreme situation. And the group of break in the silence were actually at the beginning people that actually served in Hebron and confronted this on a regular basis. I can say that I left Hebron in 2002 and got back for the first time afterwards in 2008, and I was shocked. I was shocked that the market no longer exists, even though that in 2002 already the market was much smaller and the situation was already bad. But the 6 years that have been passed since the last time I was there, the first time I was there was in Hebron in 2008, I was shocked. I was walking, and this is why we take in. We do take Hebrew and English tours to Hebron in each week. I invite whoever comes to Israel to join one of our tours in the city of Hebron, because in that place you can actually see what's the meaning of occupation and how bad can it actually be.
There's nothing pretty about occupation, and you know it firsthand, Dana, and it's not just Israel occupying the territories. Occupations are ugly worldwide. I wrote one article, and I bring it up occasionally in other articles, so-called UN peacekeepers that are assigned after a conflict in different parts of the world and different countries. The peacekeepers are not there to keep the peace. The term is totally misleading. The peacekeepers are an occupying force, and I still remember the title of the article I wrote 2 or 3 years ago. It was it focused mainly on Haiti, but I used examples in 6 or 8 other countries. And the first peacekeeping force that ever came into being, of course, there was no UN until after World War II. 1947 and 1948 it was established. So the first UN peacekeeping force was assigned to, guess where? Israel. It was a small force. It was there while Israel's War of Independence was going on. There was a hiatus period or two, and a UN peacekeeping force came in, a very small one. It never kept the peace. It never stopped the war. And as of the time I wrote that article a few years ago, that so-called peacekeeping force was still there. It was still there. But you could go to different countries around the world, and I called my article UN Paramilitary Peacekeeping or Peacekeepers. They're really paramilitaries. They're not peacekeepers. I don't know what the first one was. The first one was small. It was so small and inconsequential, it couldn't really do anything, and I'm not certain that it tried. So that was a different kind of peacekeeping mission. And it went there in the middle of a conflict, which peacekeeping is not supposed to be. It's supposed to be after a conflict is over, as a temporary situation to stabilize an unstable country after a conflict, before the government, the governing authority of that country or that region, can take over and do its own police keeping. But UN peacekeepers never go there to keep the peace. They are very repressive, and they certainly are that way in Haiti, but they're that way in the Congo, they're that way in Sudan, they're that way in numerous other places where they are now or where they have been deployed in the past. It's very disturbing. They do some of the same things. If the soldiers in those missions could report the way breaking the silence soldiers reported, you would hear the same kind of stories that you published in your reports, the exact same kind of things. They do the same kind of things. They commit horrendous offenses against civilian people. So it's not just in the territories.
Of course, and many people here tell me that. Many people in America tell me, what do you think about the American soldier in Iraq? And what I keep saying, with all due respect to other people, I do care first about my own society. So maybe other people are doing a worse thing than what's going on in the territories, but for me in person, I don't care if there are better or worse cases. I care that for me what's going on in the territories is disturbing enough. And I know that occupation corrupts, and I know that the power corrupts, but I feel that I need to fight for my own society, and I need to fight for what my own society is doing first.
You know, let me add one thing. The American occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, those are not peacekeeping operations. Those occupations are the aftermath of two illegal wars of aggression. There's no debate about that. International law, again, is very, very clear in very simple language, for me, English. A high school kid could very easily read it and understand it very, very clearly, no ambiguity whatsoever. Not only did the U.S. Break international law, the U.S. broke U.S. law by illegally attacking both countries that posed no threat to America or anyone else. And now we illegally occupy those countries, not as peacekeepers, as oppressors. That is the mission, to hold those people down, to totally control those countries, and probably to stay there for the duration. And I love to use examples. Korea, Japan. Japan, 1945. Korea, 1953. We sent occupying forces to those countries. They're still there. They're still there. That's the fate of Iraq. That's the fate of Afghanistan. Very, very oppressive. And the details that I've written voluminously on in past articles, oh, my goodness, it is too gruesome to imagine. We're talking about the numbers of deaths and so on and so forth that run into numbers that are very hard to contemplate because they are so immense, and they continue every single day, especially in Afghanistan where the war rages. But again, focusing back to the territories and what you see, I, like you, somehow want a way to resolve this and have peace, not conflict. Let me say one thing very strongly, Dana. I believe that the only way this can be achieved is for ordinary people to put on enough relentless pressure of their political leaders, so much so that they force them to do what they otherwise will never do. And I know the history of my country very well, and I write about it a fairly good number of times. The only major changes for the better that have ever occurred in U.S. history always came from the grassroots. Again, ordinary people wanting something and working hard enough to make it happen. The political leaders at the top never do it. The best political leaders America ever had, people that young kids are taught in school to revere, it's a false teaching because there's no reason to revere them. But the best we ever had never did it until people pressured them to do it. That's the same globally. It's not Israel alone. It's not America alone. That's the way it is everywhere, with only really an exception. There are exceptions, but they are extremely rare. So it's up to us, Dana, to bring about the change that we want. And if we don't do it, it will never happen. So I encourage you and others in Israel to do it. I encourage people in my own country to do it, because we all want to just live a normal life in peace, to live and let live, as we like to say here. There's no other way. The alternative is very, very grim, very gruesome.
That's why we encourage people to get to know the fact and to know the truth, and by that take a stand. And I believe that if people will take a stand, we will have a better world. This is why we're fighting so hard to do the work that we're doing in breaking the silence. Exactly that.
Oh, well, I agree with you. It's that better world that we want, and by doing what you're doing an awfully important thing, Dana, to bring that about. I hope many others in Israel appreciate what you're doing. I mean, you all have families. You talk to them. They know what you're doing. If you tell them what's going on, I imagine conversations in households talk about things like this. I mean, you've been there. You've seen things. You must talk about it with your friends, with your family, exchange ideas. There have to be an awful lot of people in Israel very upset about this, and I know this is a fact. In fact, there's an exodus of Israeli Jews who are fed up with what they see going on. They're very upset with what's going on, and they've endured this for many, many years. And even though there's immigration coming into the country, there is a substantial number of Jewish people who simply don't want to live under this anymore, and they're leaving Israel forever, and they'll never come back there to live again because of what's going on.
I guess in breaking the silence, we take a different kind of way. We're staying and we're trying to fight for our own society while we're still there. Maybe we're still a bit optimistic. Otherwise, we would have all gone and leave the place. But we believe that change can be done. And I believe that in a way it's not easy. It's not easy with my family. It's not easy with my friends. People do not like to talk about those issues, but we keep repeating and repeating again and again. There is no other choice but actually talking about that. Because I was ready to believe that if I want to solve a problem, I should talk about it.
Absolutely, without question. For a young person, you have a lot of wisdom. You're wiser than I was when I was your age. I think I lived more in a cocoon. The world was a bit different when I was your age. I don't know your exact age, but you're still young compared to me.
I'm 27. I'm still younger in general.
I want to believe that I'm still young in general. I guess as I got through my mid-20s. But I served in the U.S. Army for 2 years, but I did it in the 1950s, and it was after the Korean War and before the Vietnam War. I didn't plan it that way, but it certainly was a very good time for me to serve in the Army. And it was a quiet time. And there was no way I could get upset about what I saw going on around me. I stayed in the U.S. I was never sent abroad. I almost was at the end. I was almost sent to Korea, but it was getting a little bit close to the time I'd be discharged. So I was not sent, and I was just as happy not to go. I finished up my time, and I got done. But I never saw combat. I never saw the things that you and the other Breaking the Silence soldiers saw. So I have no first-hand reason to say I don't like what I'm seeing going around me. I had no reason to feel that. I had to self-educate myself, because in the U.S. they don't teach you that in school. They don't teach you that in college. You have to learn these things by yourself. Slowly over the years, I began doing reading a lot more as I got older, and it was really shocking for me to discover what my teachers never taught me. They should have taught me that, but they never taught me the most important things that I learned. So my real education is the one that I gave myself, and that's the reason, accidentally, as it turned out, I do a lot of writing now. I do radio now. It's all volunteer for me, Dana. This is my time to give back, to let others know what I've learned. And it's so important. We're talking about our survival. We literally are talking about our survival. And if we don't do this, then at some point, things may get so bad that we will threaten our own survival, our families, and heaven forbid the planet itself. And we certainly have the weapons that can do it. We didn't when I was a boy growing up, but we have weapons that can destroy the world almost in a snap of the fingers. It's very, very scary. And unfortunately, in my country, like yours, like most others, there are some very extremist people around. I can name them in my own country. They carry both the Democrat and the Republican label. And if those people get too much power and are able to exert it, I shudder to think what they might think of doing. We will all be the losers if they're able to do it. So we have to take a stand, inform people, and hopefully enough public opinion arousal will stop them and we'll have a much better world. I'm committed for it. I think you are, too.
I am, and I hope the people who listen to us as well will do that as well. Take a stand, get more information, and inform yourself with more and more of the details, and take a stand. This is the most important thing.
Are you almost done with your tour now? You're in Denver now. Are you heading to California?
No, I just got here from San Francisco.
No, I mean the next stop after. Were in San Francisco.
I was in San Francisco already. I'm just doing Denver and Boulder, and the next stop is Tel Aviv.
Oh, so you're heading home after Denver?
Yeah, 3 weeks of the United States is enough. I need to go talk with my people a bit as well.
I did a lot of traveling in my former working life, and I must say, over the years, the more I did, the less I liked it. I was very happy when I got home. There is no place like home, Dana. You know that.
Yeah, I know. No, traveling is difficult. Traveling Eastern Coast for three weeks.
It weighs you down. I used to like to say, my favorite hotel is inside my front door, and my favorite restaurant is in my kitchen.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, I wish you a very safe trip back, and I hope you continue this heroic work and publish some more reports as well. I have a feeling that there'll be more and more participants wanting to have their say, so you'll be able to have a lot more testimonies to be able to publish, men and women, and what you do is so important. I want to mention your website. It's a name that is hard to remember. Let me direct people to your website by just saying Google Breaking the Silence.
Okay, it's actually
right
quite easy. It's www.breakingthesilence.org.il for Israel.
Oh, okay. I'm looking at the one that is, you pronounce
it's
it.
The Hebrew one is Shavrim Shtika, which is the Hebrew way to say breaking the silence, but you can also enter that with just Google. We're just doing breaking the silence.
.org, and you'll go right there. Well, that's the way I find it all the time. And listeners can find the reports. They can find information about Breaking the Silence, about you, the individual testimonies and so on, all kinds of information. Go there. Dana, we're out of time.
Thank you very much.
That I was able to get you on. You know I was nervous to get your phone number.
You got it.
My thanks to you and to Rebecca all your help. But it was wonderful having you on. I so much wanted to do it because of your frontline knowledge of the things that go on that I only read about and then write about. But you know it from firsthand experience. Many, many thanks. I wish you a safe trip back home. And if
thank
you ever
you
get to
much.
Chicago, this is where I live. I have a blog under my name, Steve Lenman. Steve Lenman. Easy to find. Just Google Steve Lenman blog, and you'll find it. And my email address is on the bottom of every article. But you have my email address because we've exchanged it. If you ever get to Chicago, let me know, and I'll take you out and buy you lunch or something.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
Dana. It was great talking to you.
And join us again next Thursday and every Saturday and Sunday. As I like to say, make this a regular habit.
This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.